Welcome to the Sick of the Beatles episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, here with Emily Peck, also of Axios.
Hello.
And I'm also here with Vipal Monga of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Vipal.
Hi, guys.
You have been crushing it. You are, what, the full-time Canadian, everything Canadian person at the Journal.
Canada correspondent, yes.
The Canada correspondent, like the Journal will have many people covering many things, and then it has like you covering Canada. That's like, you know.
We actually have three people here. Some great colleagues of mine are here too.
You wrote a great piece about oil sands in Canada. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Canadian house prices, what's going on there. But really, we brought you on to talk about the Beatles, which is your favorite band. Am I right? Oh,
yeah, enough with that. Those guys.
Enough with those guys. They've been around for too long, and there's got to be something better. Vipal's controversial opinions on Get Back, the documentary, and the Beatles, coming up on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oil prices are in the news. Oil leases are in the news. The big news is that oil prices are high because the entire world basically can't produce enough of it to meet demand. The federal government, which came into office claiming that it would ban all drilling on federal lands, ended up being forced by courts to allow drilling in federal seas, I guess I should say. That's now been put on hold by another court in DC. The one place that drilling is happening at stronger and bigger quantities than ever is, Vipal, Alberta, Canada?
Alberta, Canada, the oil sands.
So tell me, and this is particularly filthy oil.
It is been called the dirtiest oil in the world. It releases more carbon, is more carbon intensive than any other oil that's pulled out of the ground.
And another wonderful story, that which we will link to in the show notes, talks about Shell, which has operations up there, tried to do a carbon capture plant, but everyone's kind of skeptical about that. Like, when oil is this dirty, it's hard to counteract or countermand or capture the emissions, right?
Right, and it's question of what you're releasing into the air, carbon versus methane, and methane's the real problem.
Not to mention just the physical environmental impact where you just destroy an entire landscape.
Right. About the oil sands, I talked to one environmentalist who called it the most visible scar on the surface of the earth, which a little bit of a hyperbole, but it's pretty ugly up there.
This is one of those things which, like, you know, you can see from the moon. Yeah.
Can you, when people say oil sands, in my uneducated mind, I picture a beach that's oily. Literally, what does the oil sands look like?
Right. You're not too far from the truth. So the oil sand deposit in Alberta is basically made up of bitumen, which is like a thick, really viscous oil. It's kind of like asphalt. They make asphalt from it. There's so much of it that it bubbles to the surface. So you do see it on the ground. You'll see a lot of aerial shots of the region. The ground is black. Where there's puddles, it's black oily puddles. That's what it looks like.
If, like, in a previous episode of Slate Money Goes to the Movies, we covered There Will Be Blood, and there's that scene in There Will Be Blood where he goes out into the California desert and there's like a puddle of oil, and it's basically like that.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of it, and it's always been there.
And then bigger picture, what I thought was interesting about your piece is that the bigger oil companies, the more established ones, are sort of getting out of the oil sands of the business in Alberta because it's so it's considered so dirty and reputationally it's kind of bad. But that's not stopping oil drilling; like it's still going on. And I feel like that's what's going to happen everywhere. Maybe, I don't know. What do you think?
So when Shell says they're going to leave the oil sands or sell their assets in the oil sands, it's not like they're shutting off the spigot and walking away after closing down the plant. They're selling them. They're selling them to Canadian companies who become by far the biggest owners in the region. And they keep drilling. I mean, they have every incentive because they make a lot of money doing it. And they're drilling more than ever.
So to ask the basic question, let's say that I am an environmentalist and I pressure Shell to get out of dirty oil sands production, and they do. And then they just end up selling that dirty oil sands production to someone else. Like, is that in any way a victory for me?
Well, I guess the question is short-term versus long-term. What's been happening is investment in the oil sands has been dropping. So in the short term, drilling continues and they are pulling a lot of oil out of the ground, more than ever before, at 3.8 million barrels a day this year. But over the long term, because they're not investing in it, they're not creating new oil fields. They're not drilling new wells. So what you would expect, we haven't seen it yet, but what you would expect is in the next 10, 20 years, some of these older wells will start to dry up and you won't have new ones to replace them. So longer term, they should, kind of go into runoff, which would be a victory if it happens, but I'm not sure it will.
So I have a question about that, which is when you talk about investment, are you talking about external investment where companies issue bonds or companies issue equity and they raise money and they use that money to drill new wells? Because it strikes me that if drilling oil in Alberta is as profitable as it seems, then you don't need to raise money from banks or shareholders. You can just take your profits and use those to drill new wells, and that wouldn't show up in investment figures.
Well, they do look at capital expenditure numbers in Alberta, and that's kind of what we're using to measure that investment. But what's been happening is that the money that the oil companies are making, and they're making a lot of it, they're just funneling it back to shareholders, dividends, special dividends, buybacks. There's been a lot of that activity happening, so they're just giving it back.
So the question is, like, if these small Canadian companies that most people have never heard of, or small-ish Canadian companies that nobody's ever heard of, are doing so well in the oil sands, why are they dividending their profits back to shareholders instead of plowing them back into this very profitable business that they're quite good at?
And this is where the environmentalists seem to be winning a little bit, because the expectation is that producing oil is going to get more and more expensive over time because of the carbon tax that Canada has instituted, which is going to be ratcheting up to something like $130 a ton. Because the oil companies are expecting demand to start decreasing over time. So because of that, and it takes 5-6 years to get a new oil field up and running, they don't think it's worth their while to put the new money in unless there's some sense that the demand's going to increase enough to justify the investment.
So it seems like we're in this very painful transition from into a more green world that's less reliant on oil. But for right now, oil prices are really, really high. And that's presenting all kinds of problems, like politically, like you see the Biden administration struggling, like what Felix talked about in the introduction, where Biden came in saying, like, we're going to be more green, and then oil prices going up and Biden being like, we're going to make gas prices go down. And it's like, you can't have it all on oil here. Like, if we're going to make this transition, like, prices are going to stay high because no one's going to want to invest the money to get more oil out of the ground, and you know what I mean? Like, so the prices are going to stay elevated for a while, and that's going to really piss people off.
So the real problem everyone's having, the world's having, is that they haven't really, or we haven't really found a source of energy that's as efficient as oil. You can pull it out of the ground relatively easily. It gives you a lot of energy. It's very dirty, obviously. It's really bad. But solar, wind, or the other forms that we might have to replace them just aren't as efficient. So how are you going to fuel the power needs? And people really haven't been upfront or haven't politically been able to make the case that in order to get to this net zero objective, you're going to have to sacrifice a lot of the stuff you take for granted. Are people willing to do that is a big question. And, you know, the real extremists, I guess, if you will, are the radicals. Say, of course. I mean, we're talking about the future of humanity here. We should give up, you know, your one-day shipping from Amazon. But can you make that case to most people? And so far, the answer has been no, you can't. So then what
where does Canadian public opinion stand on this?
I think it's in line with what most of the world is. They agree that this is a bad thing that's happening. Climate change needs to be stopped and there should be some curbs. But I haven't seen much polling that suggests that they're willing to reduce their standard of living in order to get there. And that's really what's being asked of people, if we're going to be realistic about it. I mean, you know, we live pretty well these days, really comfortably. Are we willing to suffer a little bit to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
I mean, those are actions that have to be taken on like a policy level. Like, people aren't going to be like, yeah, I'll pay more for gas and give up one day shipping. But Amazon could say, we're not doing it anymore. Or the Biden administration could say, okay, the federal government's going to eat the increased gas costs or something. Like, there are things that could be done at the policy level to make it possible for this transition to be less painful, but it seems like that's not happening.
Yeah, there's a political will question. There doesn't seem to be the political will, really. And in places where there are, I mean, people are struggling. Look at what Europe is going through with, you know, their energy prices this winter. And all, you know, the issues that occurred in Texas when the power grid almost went down. I mean, things like that really scare people. And there's a lot of nuance as to what actually is happening in those areas, but no one's paying attention to the nuance. All they see is green energy means more danger, more energy insecurity, and we don't want that. So if you're a political, how do you make the clear, simple argument that you really need to sell these? One tool that can be used is the carbon tax. And I think a lot of people are hoping that governments institute that to make it more economically painful for these companies to keep drilling. And so far, not many countries have really instituted a strong one. Canada's on its way, but
So a carbon tax is coming. I mean, in Europe, carbon is what, like $30-$40? A ton right now, and you're saying in Canada it's going to go up to like three or four times that?
Yeah. I mean, it's going to ratchet up slowly and it will go up to triple what it is now, basically, or quadruple. And then, you know, what companies are trying to do is reduce the pain of that by investing in technologies which will sort of, you know, solve this whole issue, like carbon capture, which, you know, there's a lot of doubt about how efficient that actually is or whether it really works. You know, and it's almost like we're all scrambling looking for this magic bullet that'll help solve all our greenhouse gas problems without forcing us to make painful decisions about the way we live. And maybe we're in the denial phase at this point if we're looking at
how but the big picture that I'm getting from you is that in terms of pollution, in terms of emissions, there's a pretty good chance that we're at the worst point right now in terms of the oil sands, and that it is going to get better over the next 5-10 years. And that, like, it looks really bad right now, but there is some kind of light at the end of the tunnel if you just look at things like CapEx.
Yes, if you do. And we're talking 10, 15 years, not 5-10. So it's a little bit of a longer time frame. But yeah, that's an optimistic scenario. The cynics would say that things like carbon capture are going to be used to continue to allow the oil sands companies to drill even more, because one of the ways people will be using the carbon will be to drill even more oil. And we might see that come up. And, you know, if you look at companies like, I think it's ConocoPhillips that, I can't remember which one actually, that basically says 2-degree warming is a fool's errand. We're going to overshoot that, completely overshoot that. So we're not even going to try to reduce our emissions, because it's, you know, it's ridiculous what you're asking people to do.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to segue here into a little discussion of the Canadian property market, which is actually related because Canada is one of those countries which kind of benefits from global warming, right? Like if you have property in Toronto or Vancouver, suddenly that looks kind of increasingly relatively attractive in a world that's burning up. And Canadian property is, mix my metaphors horribly here, on fire right now. Crazy expensive. And the one thing that Canadians love to sort of moan about the most, right?
It is pretty much unaffordable if you're a first-time home buyer to buy a home in Canada right now. I mean, home prices have basically risen without stopping for the past 20 years or so. There's been nothing like the 2008 crash that we saw in the US to sort of tamp down home prices. And yeah, I mean, there's not enough supply in this market at all to feed the demand, and demand keeps increasing. So I'm just looking at the basics there. Yeah, it's crazy, crazy expensive.
What, talk about the supply and demand dynamics. Is the demand coming from people who are like running away from future global warming and they're wanting to get a safe space in Canada?
Canada has really been emphasizing immigration as a way to sort of keep growing its economy. Last year, Canada welcomed 400,000 immigrants, or gave them permanent resident status, which is Canada's version of the green card, which is the most ever. The U.S., by contrast, not only has the 2019 numbers, only gave out something like 1 million green cards in 2019. Remember, the U.S. is about 10 times the size of Canada. So, you know, per capita, or I guess the relative basis, Canada has welcomed a lot of immigrants. Why they're coming, we don't know exactly. But all of them want houses. So that is a big portion of the demand. There's also a lot of investment coming into Canada, just people buying into this crazy housing market in order to flip them and make money.
So is Canada having the same kind of demand issues in the real estate market as we're having in the US? Like the pandemic really pushed a lot of people to move, driving up prices kind of everywhere in weird places and driving down supply like to an insane degree? Or is it really more the immigration lever that's pushing demand?
So demand has been persistent in Canada, but we have seen people leaving places like Toronto. I think this was the first year that Toronto saw net negative migration into the city. Places like Vancouver are losing people too. So people are moving out, and you are starting to see home prices rise in suburbs, you know, out like an hour, 2 hours outside of Toronto. Even in places like the Maritimes near Halifax. So this contagion, if you will, of rising home prices is increasing beyond the major urban centers. But again, there's been sort of like, if you look at the slope, there's been like a unabated rise, like a slope is steepening in terms of house prices in Canada. So it's really concerning for people who want to buy a home.
So I have two questions, but let me start with the first big one, which is, why is there seemingly no supply? Well, what's the supply problem? Is it the same as in California? It's all NIMBYs, or is it more structural?
A lot of NIMBYism. It's just a lot harder. I mean, the bureaucratic apparatus in Canada is, you know, much more unwieldy than it is in the U.S. So there's provincial rules, municipal rules, just harder to get stuff built. In Canada, for example, they've built an area around the city called the Green Belt, which is kind of like a boundary meant to stop sprawl. A lot of buildings in Toronto are pretty short, like 2 or 3 stories. You don't see a lot of mid-rise buildings, so it's not very dense as a city. So things like that have limited growth and home building. A lot of people like single family homes, and it's harder to build those, and more expensive now, especially if you look at things like lumber prices, which have been going crazy.
Because of Canadian problems, Vipal, right? A lot of flooding and such.
Canadian problems. That's right. Well, they've limited, I mean, the whole timber thing is a whole different thing, but Canada's a lot to do with why lumber is so expensive.
Blame Canada.
The bigger question I had is about the worries here, because, and I've seen this in California, I've seen this in New Zealand, I've seen this in Canada, I've seen this in London, wherever you see house prices go up. On the one hand, people are saying, this is really bad, everything has become unaffordable, no one can afford to live here anymore, it destroys communities, it destroys the soul of neighborhoods. But on the other hand, people become incredibly fearful of house prices going down. Like, it's unclear whether they actually want house prices to go down, because people are so invested in their homes. They have so much equity in their homes, especially if they've bought recently. They certainly don't want to be underwater on their mortgages. And so it seems that people can't, like the polis, the population as a whole, can't decide whether it wants prices to come down or not.
It goes back to that thing we're talking about in energy. House prices coming down would be broadly good for young people who want to, you know, sort of create wealth, have a home to live in. But in order to get there, some people are going to have to absorb some pain, you know. And it's in Canada, for example, a lot of the home buying is coming from what they call investors. So it's not just the Blackstones and the private equity firms snapping up, you know, whole neighborhoods and renting them out. It's also people, baby boomers, who already own a home and are buying another house or a condo to rent it out and make money off that. There's a lot of those people. Are they willing to absorb the shock? And no, they're not. I mean, so there's a lot of fear about a plunge.
Have rents been going up as fast as prices, or is it still like possible to find affordable rents?
Rents are, I mean, they're going up quite a bit. Toronto is it's insanely expensive to live here. Rentals are comparable to New York without all the benefits of being a New Yorker, frankly. So yeah, I mean, there's a housing crisis. You know, they keep hitting home the fact that there's a crisis Canada-wide in terms of housing.
My colleague at Axios and I were talking about the lament of there are no homes to buy, like you can't get a house anymore argument. And he was saying, and I'm going to float this here right now, debut it. People are too picky. Like, you can't find a house in Park Slope. Homes are not affordable anymore. And it's like, well, actually, Park Slope's quite expensive. Like, you could find a house if you go farther out into Brooklyn or farther out into Queens. Like, yeah, you might not be able to live in the most desirable neighborhood anymore because it's extremely expensive. But home buyers need to sort of like chill and buy houses they can afford in neighborhoods maybe they don't, that maybe they believe aren't as desirable. But if more people move to them, it all works out anyway. So instead of forcing people to eat a lower home value, you just force people into homes with lower values. You know what I mean? Like, there's a sort of like mindset.
So there is a ratchet. There is a ratchet effect here, I think. If you look at the United States in particular, and this goes for everywhere, whether it's out in the middle of nowhere or like in the middle of city centers, the number of square feet per person has been going up steadily for decades, and and there's no sign of that changing. Yeah, people want more space. And I think this is one of the big effects of the pandemic, is that people want much more space post-pandemic because home isn't just somewhere you live. It's also somewhere you work. And that desire for more space, like, you know, sure, that like the price per square foot will go down in less convenient neighborhoods or whatever. But if the number of square feet per person goes up, you don't need any immigration at all for demand to start exceeding supply, because the supply is measured in square feet, right? Add in a little bit of immigration or natural population growth, and just the entire market starts becoming very, very, let's just say, bullish for the people who like property prices going up. Like, it just becomes structurally very hard to avoid prices going up.
That is not the dynamic that we're seeing in Toronto. In Toronto, house prices are, I think the technical term is cuckoo bananas. You can buy like homes that are in dire need of renovation, basically gut renovation homes, are selling for multiples of asking price. I mean, worse, you know, there are constantly stories of people, lines around the corner for homes, you know, people standing around in the dead of winter to buy homes, which, you know, are not particularly desirable. And we're not talking about like, you know, Rexdale or other neighborhoods that are maybe, quote unquote, less desirable. It's, how do I say it? It's hysterical, I think, is the behavior we're seeing of buyers here, because there is nothing else to buy.
And there was definitely that kind of hysteria in the United States last year. It seems to have maybe anecdotally died down a little bit. Like, a lot of the people who are desperate to buy a home probably ended up buying one somehow. And maybe it's less hysterical right now. But house prices are still going up. House price inflation is still going up. And it all comes down on some level, I think, to this very American thing, and I'm interested in whether it's a Canadian thing. I think it is, that like home ownership is considered a necessity, that like people really, really need to own their homes. And they're like, I need to move somewhere, I need to buy somewhere. It's the same thing. And that is complicating matters. It's, you know, it's the opposite of somewhere like Germany, where home ownership is kind of weird. And like, why would you want to own a place?
The head of the Canadian Mortgage Housing Corporation, which is a government backed home insurer, Evan Siddall, former head, made that very argument. He said, why do people need to buy? What's wrong with renting? I mean, renting might be a better use of your money than paying a mortgage and all the risks that entails. So there's a pretty significant section of the population that's starting to buy into that a little bit. But of course, rents are also increasing. So it's getting tougher on both ends.
I mean, in a high inflation environment, it's better to own a home than to rent. Rents are going up like crazy. There's lots of inflation. My mortgage payment is the same every month. You know, it's only going down, basically.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before. Or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C., on Tuesday, May the 14th, my colleague Mark Joseph Stern and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice. all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I want to move on to the music industry because, Vipal, you are my favorite music nerd in the world. And I want to ask you about a statistic that came across desks this week saying that 70% of all music being played right now is old, where old is defined as more than 18 months old, but that counts as old in the hot pop music world. And I've been talking to a few friends about this, and it does seem to be, like, anecdotally, that music, fresh music, new music isn't this cultural force that it used to be. While old music from, like, even like 30, 40 years ago, Genesis just announced a tour and it's selling out and they're like number 4 on the Bloomberg top artists chart. Old music is doing well. All of the septuagenarians like Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan are selling their catalogs for $1 gazillion because old music seems to be this license to print money, which is going to last forever. What is going on?
Everyone's competing with the Beatles or the Police. If you're a new band, getting people to listen to your fresh sounds just getting harder and harder because the old guys are not going away. They live in perpetuity, have been granted immortality through like the streaming services, which wasn't the case a few years ago when you would go into the record store to have, buy music or depend on the radio play to get access. The new bands would push out the old guys. And I think it's terrible for new music, what's happening.
But was it ever thus, like, when we had physical media, when people used to buy LPs and CDs, did they used to actually listen to their old, you know, Genesis and Police CDs all the time? But that wouldn't show up in the statistics because they weren't buying those CDs new. They'd owned those CDs for years and they just kept on listening to them. But now, with streaming, we're beginning to realize just how much people are listening to old music in the way that we never realized before. Maybe it isn't that new of a phenomenon.
It's not, but the economic model is relatively new. It used to be that people would listen to their white album CD or physical graffiti or whatever 100 times or whatever, but then they would still go out and buy new CDs, which would create a revenue stream, a pretty strong revenue stream for new artists. That is drying up. And I think that's the real problem for the industry.
I think Felix has a good point. I hadn't thought about it like this, but like, I remember when CDs first came out and everyone had to convert from tapes to CDs and everyone rebought all the same old music they already had. And that drove a lot of CD sales. And it's kind of like, if you think about that, it's not then surprising that old music drives streaming. Of course, people aren't going to just stop listening to old stuff because new stuff came out. And then you combine that with pandemic trends. Like I emailed with the people who did this survey or compiled this number that Felix was talking about, the 70%. And the pandemic drove a lot of this as well. Like, more old people started doing streaming during when we were all stuck at home, there was like a big migration of boomers and Gen X to streaming in a way that hadn't quite gotten there before. So they pushed up the numbers. And then the other thing that was sort of interesting is a lot of concerts didn't happen in 2021 because of pandemic. So some new releases got pushed back. And then that also like tipped the scales in favor of the old stuff. So I broke the rule and I made like 3 points in talking. So pick it up where you might.
You're allowed to. You can break the rule as much as you like, Emily.
Well, to look at it this way. Look, once you bought a CD or a record, you had it forever. You could listen to it for ultimate infinite times. Basically, you paid money for the right to listen to it forever. The record company had an incentive to have you buy new physical media because that's how they made music. So they would promote new artists. You would hear Prince, even though you've been listening to Marvin Gaye for years. All of a sudden, there's this new guy, Prince. You should listen to him, buy his records. So they had an incentive to promote the new flavor. Now all that incentive is gone. They have contracts with Spotify where they will get paid, I guess depending on the nature of the contract, by streams. And it doesn't matter whether people are listening to the Beatles or Kanye or Frank Ocean or what have you. They don't really have much incentive to push new artists or put the capital expenditure, if you will, into new promotion because they'll make just as much money with people listening to things they already know.
So I think that is 100% compelling as an argument and a reason that, you know, it's up to the record labels, and the record labels make just as much money from Genesis as they do from Dua Lipa. So why would you prefer one to the other? But I do need to ask you, Vipul, because you are, you know, the music nerd. Is it the case that there has been a fracturing of pop music and that there is just, it's not culturally relevant in the way that it used to be? No one cares that the Grammys got pushed back. No one really knows even who the top artists are. Like, I pulled the Billboard top 10 for this week. From this week and 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 30 years ago. And this week, you know, we have some weird Lin-Manuel Miranda song from an animated movie. And we have Glass Animals, who I have to admit I've never heard of. And Gunna and Gail and Jessica Darrow and Who Are These People? And then you go back 10 years and it's like, okay, then you start thinking, oh, there you have people who are real pop stars. There's Rihanna, there's Adele, there's Bruno Mars, there's Katy Perry, there's Jay-Z. Go back 20 years and, you know, it's Mary J. Blige, it's Alicia Keys. Go back 30 years and get this, the pop chart from this week 30 years ago. It's like George Michael, Prince, Mariah Carey, Nirvana, Michael Jackson, U2, right? Is it just because I'm old, or is there something much more lasting about those artists? You kind of feel like U2 is going to last much longer than Flo Rida, right?
I think it's a lot of it has to do with how we listen to music. I avoid streaming services. I still buy music. I'm a bit of a dinosaur, but I do it specifically because I think that if you're engaged in what you're putting on, if you're making the choice yourself, there's more of an emotional investment. And there was a time when music was like defined you, who you were. Now the algorithm plays in the background without you really engaging with it physically at all, just playing music. A lot of it just becomes background noise. And I think a lot of the music reflects that, and our attachment to the music is part of that, or it lessened because of it.
Not to mention album covers. Like when you physically take out album covers and you're looking at them and like you're physically handling an artist in a way that like the brand recognition for artists is just not the same these days.
I mean, it's changed, and I don't think it's good or bad. It's just the way things went. The technology kind of has moved things in that direction. It makes me a little sad. I mean, I can't remember the last song that everyone was talking about that changed things. You know, I was watching a documentary recently about Prince and, you know, people's reaction, like when Doves Cry came out and how that was like an explosion just because people hadn't really heard sounds like that before. And it just changed the way people reacted to music or what they expected from music. And you don't see much of that these days. And I don't know if the environment is conducive to that, if it can happen.
Is it just because there's like more old music than there was 30 years ago? Like when I was growing up, rock and roll was still kind of not new, but like there's just more old stuff that people listened to than like maybe in the 80s. You only went back 20, 30 years. Now we're in the 2020s and there's just like many more years of good music that still sounds pretty good. And I wondered, and maybe this is a leap, and so Felix can answer, but like old art is like really valuable. So why wouldn't old music still be really valuable and cherished and listened to in the same kind of way?
It's a really good question. And like when I was growing up in a very weird sort of family, the overwhelming majority of music I listened to was like really old. It was Bach and Mozart, you know? And yeah, and when you grow up in a classical music household like I did, the idea that there would be any kind of recency bias in what you listen to, and you're like, oh no, let's put something on by Harrison Birtwistle, you know, like no, because that people are biased against new music, and yeah, for most of human history, it has been the case that people revere the stuff that has stood the test of time more than the stuff that is fresh and new. And it's always been like, it really dates back to kind of, I guess, like Elvis and then the Beatles that created these popular culture phenomena where suddenly they, like what was fresh and new became the thing that everyone cared about. And maybe you're right. Maybe people are going back to like, we now have so many decades of amazing music to listen to. Why would we listen to some, why would we, you know, invest in learning about, I don't know, Olivia Rodrigo when you can listen to Nirvana. It's a good question. Although I will say that in the fine art market, I just saw a statistic that's saying at auction, the total auction sales of artists under the age of 40 have now exceeded in dollar value the total auction sales of old masters from like over a period of like 600 years.
Well, if you think about it, 50 years ago, the Beatles had just broken up. So if you go back 50 years, we're talking about the end of the era of the Beatles. If you were in 1969 listening to music and you went back 50 years, you'd be going back to 1919.
Yes, I mean, that is what I'm saying.
That's exactly your point.
Perfect.
But God damn it, I'm sick of the Beatles. I'm tired of hearing about this band that is really no longer relevant to what's going on right now. I mean, they make great music, yes. But do we need to watch a 100-hour documentary about them doodling in the studio? We don't.
Did you watch it, Vipo?
I watched the one clip of Get Back when Paul McCartney made it. And I watched a little bit of the Billy Preston stuff because he's awesome. But really, I listen to a Beatles song and it says nothing to me right now. It's like, the analogy I use is like, they're like water. Water's great. You need it to live. Awesome. But let's stop talking about water because it's boring. I'd rather like some flavor in my drink. And I'm much more intrigued or interested by what Megan Thee Stallion is doing than what the Beatles did 50 years ago. Or what Salt, the band, is doing. Because they're talking about things that are happening today and now, and it's just much more relevant to, I guess, our common experience. And I think that that's a part of what music used to bring and did bring to people in the 60s that maybe we're missing now. Just, you know, stuff that talks about what's going on today and how we relate to this moment. And, you know, Eleanor Rigby, I'm sure, it will always be remembered as a great tune, but I'm not sure it deserves to crowd out everything else that's going on. And it is. It's terrible.
On which note, we will get a million emails of people writing in to slatemoney@slate.com saying, how can you possibly compare Megan Thee Stallion to the Beatles? We will forward them all to you and you can answer them.
Yeah, she's awesome. I love her. Yeah.
Let's have a numbers round. Emily, did you have a number this week?
Yeah, I have a number. My number is 54%. That is the increase in hot sauce sales globally since 2015 to $5 billion. I read a great story in Bloomberg Businessweek about the spice company McCormick and hot sauce and all the ways the business is kind of changing and how the pandemic fueled McCormick's spice business and their supply chain woes. They source their spices in 80 countries. And there's also a whole thing about McCormick buying the number three hot sauce maker in the US, which is a hot sauce called Cholula, which has this like cute little wooden top and a lady on it, but was owned by a private equity company in Connecticut, which I think is funny. And
of course it was. Oh my God. Like the fact that Cholula was owned by a private equity company in Connecticut is like, that is the most sleep money thing I've heard all week.
There you go. But now it's owned by McCormick.
Have you watched those videos where people sit around and try different hot sauces and see what their hot sauce tolerance is?
Yeah, there's YouTube show.
The wings guy.
Yeah. So good and weird. So strange.
Brilliant marketing.
He's very deadpan, and he makes the celebrity eat the hot sauce and then ask these like very whatever questions while the celebrity kind of just sweats. Yeah, it's good stuff. We should do Slate Money like that.
My number is 152.5 billion dollars, which is a profits number. It's the total profits of the big six American banks in 2021. It is by far a record high. It's double what they made in 2020. It's just an absolutely astonishing amount of money for that would be the two big investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and the four big commercial banks, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Citibank. Between them, I think every single one of them made record profits last year. And I'll just throw in a sort of extra number in here, which is $100 billion. It looks like Apple made $100 billion, give or take a few cents, in 2021. This was an absolutely astonishing year for profits.
My number is 9.2 trillion, which is how much McKinsey expects the world will have to spend every year between now and 2050 for us to hit the net zero 2050 target. That's on things like infrastructure, reducing emissions. That's approximately a tenth, more than a tenth of global GDP.
And what are we spending right now?
We are spending about $6.5 trillion. So about a third less.
So we need to up that by about 50%.
Yeah.
All right, get on it, people.
You need to put some of those bank profits to
use. Build more nuclear power plants. Right. I want to see more nukes. New York State became very, very dirty overnight in terms of its energy mix the minute that they closed down the Indian Point power station.
There was a lovely moment here last year when the Pickering power plant, nuclear power plant outside of Toronto, sent out an emergency alert by mistake, saying that there was a basically implying that there was a meltdown happening at the Pickering power plant. That was really great to get first thing in the morning on a Saturday. Yeah.
What did you do? How did you react?
I kind of just shrugged my shoulders and said, "Oh well, here it comes."
Turned up the music.
There was no airborne toxic event?
No.
All right. I think that's it for us this week. We are going to have a Slate Plus segment about fintech because there's been a bunch of news about Wealthfront and Robinhood and those kind of folks. So we're going to talk about that in Slate Plus. But other than that, thanks for listening to Slate Money. Vipal Monga, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And yeah, thanks to Shayna Roth for managing to once again pull this show together. We will be back next week on Slate Money.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.